Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
Hello, listeners. Welcome to Stars of the Golden Age, a show that highlights the lives of legends from film, music, and the birth of television during Hollywood's Golden Age, with a special emphasis on their lives behind the scenes. I am your host, Erin Carlson. Today, we will be talking about James Cagney. This episode is dedicated to a wonderful and supportive listener of the show, Terry. Terry went to the same high school as James Cagney. Not at the same time, though, of course. Terry is not 126 years old. I don't think so, at least. This one's for you, Terry. Thank you so much for all your support. James Cagney was born on July 17, 1899, on the Lower East Side of Manhattan, to parents James and Carolyn Cagney. The family was poor, very poor. James Sr. worked a variety of jobs, whatever he could find. Carolyn was a first-generation Irish immigrant. In total, James and Carolyn had seven children. James Jr. was the second. Two of the Cagney children died in infancy. When you hear references of an area being a melting pot, well, turn-of-the-century New York City was about as melty as you can get. And James Cagney was right there in the middle of it throughout his childhood. His mother had spent her childhood in Ireland before immigrating to the U.S., and multiple ethnic backgrounds made up the ever-growing city. Some immigrants stayed in New York, and some continued on to build their new life elsewhere in the United States. James Cagney was surrounded by vast diversity. Although poor, he received a great cultural experience that money could never buy. "I was 22 before I ever heard an elderly man who spoke without an accent," he later said. James Cagney began working at a very young age, which was very common in those days, especially for the poor families. Everyone in the family had to pitch in to help as soon as they were old enough to do so, which was pretty young. Cagney, like his dad, had a lot of different jobs. He was a paperboy, he worked at the New York Public Library, and when he was a little older, he tried his hand at, quite literally, boxing. When he expressed his dreams of becoming a professional boxer, his tough Irish mother said that he certainly could, but he would have to beat her first. So he scrapped that idea and became a maitre d' at a fancy tea room instead. Seems like a decent compromise. I'm sure his mother was much happier with that career move. James also played baseball as a kid, and he took tap dancing lessons. I think more like street lessons than proper lessons. But either way, he became quite good at it. When he graduated from high school in 1918, the same high school as Terry, which I read was named Stuyvesant High School, he enrolled at Columbia University, majoring in art studies and German language. He also joined the ROTC. Well, it was called the Student Army Training Corps then. He did this because he was strongly considering a career in the military. But 1918, the year that brought heartbreak and tragedy to countless families all across the world. The Spanish flu pandemic. Unfortunately, the Cagney family was greatly affected by the influenza. James Cagney Sr. died. and Carolyn was pregnant with their seventh child at the time of his death. James Jr. dropped out of college and returned home. His family needed him. He had to get back to work. James's older brother, Henry, was involved in their local community theater as an actor, and he began enlisting his brother's help for some of their productions, when he wasn't busy working elsewhere or helping their mother. James was a skilled and hardworking stagehand, but he landed on the stage one evening when his brother Henry was sick and couldn't perform his part. The director talked James into it. He had a keen photographic memory, so what lines he didn't already know from observing rehearsals, he was able to memorize from the script very easily and save the day. Well, he loved it. The audience reacted very well to James's performance, and that kind of audience gratification was pretty exhilarating. Just like that, he was hooked. Unfortunately, acting in community theater wasn't exactly going to put food on the table, so he continued to work elsewhere as well. At this time, in 1919, 20-year-old James Cagney got a job at a local department store, and then after that, at a brokerage house, and then a luggage carrier, and then at the ticket counter of the theater. His resume would have been 10 pages long, but he was working, and he was working hard. Any chance he could, though, he was going to be at that theater. James Cagney's first official part on stage was in a play called Every Sailor. It was described as, quote, a wartime musical with a chorus made up of servicemen dressed as women, end quote. I guess he had to be there. Either way, Cagney later said, and that is how I really began to learn dancing, as a chorus girl. His next role was in a play called Pitter Patter. He was paid $50 per week for that part, but gave $40 of it to his mother, who, by the way, was really urging James to return to Columbia now and finish that degree. But he didn't want to leave the theater. And it's a good thing because it was at this theater where he met a girl named Frances Willard Vernon, or Billy to her friends. Billy was 16 years old when they met and was a member of the chorus line in Pitter Patter. James Cagney married Billy Vernon on September 28, 1922. And you're never going to believe this, unless you already know this, but he remained married to her for the rest of his life. Considering James's future in Hollywood, this is virtually unheard of. So good for them. A couple of years into their marriage, James and Billy decided to take a big chance and move from New York to Hollywood. They could barely afford to feed themselves in New York, but they were going to figure it out. They had to give it a try. James got a job as a dance teacher in LA, but things just weren't falling into place as easily as they'd hoped. They eventually realized they couldn't afford to stay. They needed to move back east near their families. They were so poor that they had to borrow money from friends for the train fare, for both ways actually. James attributes their survival during this time to his young wife. He said, quote, it was rough, at times no food in the larder, big holes in the shoes. When I didn't have a penny, she was out working. Life seemed just a never-ending sequence of badly furnished rooms with a one-burner plate. There were many times when I was sorely tired and decided to get out of the acting business, to go out and get any kind of job that would bring in a weekly paycheck. But every time I mentioned it, my Billy told me with pleasant firmness, no. End quote. Billy had James's back. She believed in him. And he loved her so dang much. James continued to do plays in New York and worked his way into better and better parts in better and better productions. He taught dance in New York, too, and was the choreographer for a couple of plays. In two or three of these plays, a hopeful actress named Joan Blondell was a co-star. Luck would finally be on James Cagney's side when one L. Jolson was in the audience for a performance of Penny Arcade with Cagney and Blondell. L. Jolson was colored impressed and bought the rights to the play. He marched into Warner Brothers with it, and they bought it, with one condition. James Cagney and Joan Blondell would reprise their stage parts in the film version at Warner Brothers. This was the big break James Cagney needed, and it wouldn't be long before he was typecast as the tough guy. Penny Arcade was renamed Sinner's Holiday for the screen. It was released in 1930 to mediocre reviews, but James Cagney was offered a 7-year contract with Warner Brothers, and that was huge. His salary was $400 per week. That would equate to $7,700 per week today. This was huge money for him, having grown up so poor. I mean, it would be huge money for a lot of us, I think. But it was really unheard of money for James Cagney. And remember, this is during the Great Depression, too. There was one very important stipulation in this contract with Warner Brothers, though. Yes, it was a 7-year contract, but that didn't mean 7 years of guaranteed security with a cushy weekly paycheck. In his contract, it would be written that he would be evaluated every 40 weeks. And at each 40-week point, the execs at Warner could break the contract and let him go. So he really had to put his all into the projects they were giving him, and every 9 or 10 months, he was walking on eggshells. James Cagney fell really easily into the gangster films. And then a few films down the road came his really big break in 1931, The Public Enemy. The Public Enemy was hugely successful and one of the very first movies to ever gross more than $1 million. Some theaters ran the movie 24 hours per day to keep up with the audience demand. A New York Herald reviewer described James Cagney's performance, quote, "the most ruthless, unsentimental appraisal of the meanness of a petty killer the cinema has yet devised," end quote. James Cagney set the stage for a whole new type of Hollywood actor. So The Public Enemy was huge, and it was making Warner Brothers a ton of money. As was his next film, the comedy Blonde Crazy with Joan Blondell. James Cagney knew his worth at the studio, so he asked for a raise. They said no, so he quit. He may have been grateful for the work and that generous paycheck while the whole world was suffering the effects of the Great Depression, but he also wasn't going to put up with a bunch of rich Hollywood pencil pushers disrespecting him. He described it like this, quote, "The trouble surfaced when I realized that there were roughly two classes of stars at Warner's, those getting $125 per picture, and yours sincerely, who was getting all of $400 per week. That $400 soon stopped because I walked," end quote. He was still that tough New York street kid underneath that Hollywood exterior, and he just simply wasn't going to put up with anyone's crap. So he and Billy packed up and moved back to New York. End of James Cagney's Hollywood story? No, of course not. Not yet. He had his brother Bill in his corner. Bill went to Warner Brothers and laid out a good case for his brother. Between this move and the realization that the movie-going public wanted more of James Cagney, the studio caved. And in a pretty big way. He was asked to come back, and his $400 per week salary was raised to an impressive $1,000 per week. Back to Hollywood he went, and he immediately began shooting his next film, Taxi. First of all, James Cagney was able to showcase some of that dance talent in Taxi. Second, and I talked a little about this on a recent bonus episode on Patreon, but James Cagney was nearly killed during the filming of Taxi. Live ammunition was usually used still instead of using blanks, and Cagney narrowly missed being hit by machine gun fire. He had a close call in a previous movie, too. Well, that was enough almost shootings for James Cagney. From that point forward, he He refused to appear in a scene where live ammunition was used. Now, James Cagney was really happy with his shiny new $1,000 per week salary. But what he really would have liked to have was a $4,000 per week salary. That's what his peer, Edward G. Robinson, was making, and he wanted to make it too. He tried the same tactic as last time, threatening to walk out. But the studio did not cave. Instead, they suspended him. After several months of back and forth, a deal was finally made. $3,000 per week and guaranteed top billing with a maximum of 4 movies per year. That $3,000 would be about $74,700 per week today. Per week. Not too shabby. Rags to riches indeed. The year was 1933. 1933 also saw the creation of the Screen Actors Guild, and James Cagney was among its very first board members. The Screen Actors Guild is a union for actors that helps look out for their best interests against the film studios. It provides protection for fair wages, healthy working hours, film set safety, and lots more. By the early 1930s, there was a lot of unfairness in the world of filmmaking. The studio execs were living the high life, but the actors and extras were often being treated pretty unfairly. The Great Depression did not help things. At that point, many actors were presented with a substantial salary cut by the studios, some up to 50%. Actors were required to work insanely long hours with just a few hours off to rest before the next workday. One example was Boris Karloff during the shooting of Frankenstein in 1931. One shoot lasted for 25 hours. He was required to be working, made up as Frankenstein, for 25 long hours without a rest. The Screen Actors Guild was originally founded by 6 actors, but not high-profile actors. Most of them were still being treated pretty decent. The first high-profile actors to join SAG were Frederick March, Robert Montgomery, Ann Harding, Eddie Cantor, Groucho Marx, and James Cagney. James Cagney, Frederick March, and Robert Montgomery even helped fund SAG in its early days out of their own pockets, and they all served on the board of directors. Cagney was heavily involved with SAG for the rest of his career, serving as both vice president and president of the board in his time there. James Cagney was a huge star by 1935, and he was making a ton of money, thanks much in part to his stern negotiating with the studio and his work with the Screen Actors Guild. But fame and fortune never went to his head. He wasn't one of those guys whose identity completely transformed when he became a wealthy movie star. He was still the James Cagney from the Lower East Side of Manhattan. Still the James Cagney who worked for pennies on the small community stage. Still the James Cagney who loved his wife Billy more than anything on earth. He considered his job just as most other people did about their jobs. It was his job, that's all. It just happened to be a very enjoyable and very high-paying job. And he was forever grateful for that. But he had no interest in partaking in the Hollywood social scene. He preferred evenings at home with his wife. James and Billy purchased a dream home away from home in 1935. A 100-acre farm on Martha's Vineyard. This is where he would go to get grounded again, to reestablish peace in his life. Hollywood was a tough place to live for someone who just wanted to do their job and go home to a peaceful existence. An escape from it all was good for the soul. When they were there, they were just as ordinary as everyone else in the community. They were everyday people. But then, word got out about the peaceful farm on Martha's Vineyard, and fans began showing up on the property to catch a glimpse of the star. He, of course, was not okay with this and started a little rumor that his farm was protected 24/7 by armed guards. Poor Spencer Tracy came to visit one time, and his cab driver refused to drive him up the long dirt road that led to the farm. "I heard they shoot," he told him. So Spencer Tracy had to walk the long dirt road to get to James Cagney's door. So his little fib worked, it seemed. James had become fascinated with the idea of having a peaceful rural setting of his very own early in life, after a family trip in their first automobile, a trip to the country. It was the first time James Cagney had seen large expanses of trees, and he thought it was the most beautiful thing in the world. An area filled with trees as far as the eye could see, not buildings and people as far as the eye could see, and so much quiet and peace. He knew then, as a child, that he wanted that kind of life someday. And now he was able to have it. His own little piece of heaven on earth. The farmhouse itself was in definite need for some TLC. It was built, I think, in the late 1700s. But that did not deter James Cagney. He was in it for the natural surroundings. The house could always be fixed up or replaced. He said of this private haven when he first laid his eyes on it, quote, "I loved it beyond words, and at the time I said to myself, if I had just 6 months to live, I'd spend them at the vineyard," end quote. The best part? The property taxes were only $39 per year. Adjusted for inflation, that would still only be $900 per year today. I imagine the property taxes on Martha's Vineyard are a little bit steeper today. I should mention, the purchase of this Martha's Vineyard farm coincided with yet another contract dispute between James Cagney and Warner Brothers. It wasn't about money this time. He was pretty content with his paycheck. It was about them taking a little more than they were supposed to under his contracted terms. Remember, his contract stated that he would always have top billing and he would only be required to make 4 pictures per year. Well, they stretched that out to 5 films in 1934, and they put his good friend and frequent co-star, Pat O'Brien, in top billing in one of them. James Cagney was happy for Pat, but he wasn't one to be pushed around or taken advantage of. So, he walked out again. And he was fine if he stayed on that farm forever and never returned to Hollywood. But that's not what happened. He did return to Hollywood, just not back to Warner Brothers, not yet at least. He was mad at them. Instead, Cagney was offered a pretty sweet deal from a new studio, Grand National Films. They had really big hopes of their success, so they offered him $100,000 per film and 10% of each of the film's profits. He took a chance on this new studio. But as we all know, it was really, really difficult for new or smaller studios to hold a candle to the Big Five. James Cagney made 2 movies with Grand National before the studio folded. Warner Brothers wanted James Cagney back. They knew that he was worth a lot to them. So they came back with an offer of $150,000 per film and a requirement of only 2 films per year. And he could pick and choose those films and do more if he chose to. He also negotiated that his brother Bill would be hired as the assistant director for every single film that he appeared in. James Cagney's career was back on track, and the big bucks were rolling in with even more force. He was the highest paid star at Warner Brothers and the second highest paid actor in the entire film industry, second only to Cary Grant. 19 years into their marriage, in 1941, James and Billy were still going strong, but they weren't able to have any children. And they wanted a child. So they adopted a little baby boy that year and named him James Cagney III. A few years down the road, they adopted a little girl and named her Kathleen. Unfortunately, although the children were provided for in a lifestyle they likely would have never received elsewhere, James and Billy did not provide for them emotionally. They turned out to be not the best parents. They had a deep devotion to one another, but that devotion didn't appear to extend to their children. The kids were raised mostly by nannies and even lived primarily in a different building on the property. As adults, James III and Kathleen would estrange themselves from their parents, James and Billy. 1942's Yankee Doodle Dandy was quite a step away from James Cagney's typical gangster-type films. It would become his all-time favorite film from his career, and it earned him an Academy Award for Best Actor. After the huge success of Yankee Doodle Dandy, James left Warner Brothers again, and he and his brother Bill formed Cagney Productions with the intent of making their own movies and having them released through United Artists. One of their biggest priorities was to showcase strong supporting actors who had been continually pushed aside in Hollywood. James wanted their talents to shine and their work to be applauded and recognized. Unfortunately, back to that Big Five studio running Hollywood thing again, the company didn't survive, and James Cagney eventually returned to Warner Brothers once again. Cagney also joined the USO in 1942 and toured military bases, mostly performing numbers from Yankee Doodle Dandy. James Cagney got more involved in politics during the 1940s. While he began his adult life with a more liberal stance, he eventually shifted his views to more conservative ideals. Like many others in Hollywood, he was investigated by the House Un-American Acts Committee for his views and associations, but he was ultimately cleared. James Cagney appeared on screen regularly throughout the remainder of the 1940s and the 1950s. He co-starred with Barbara Stanwyck, Bob Hope, Henry Fonda, Jack Lemmon, Robert Wagner, Barbara Payton, and Doris Day, to name a few greats. In 1955, James and Billy bought another farm. They purchased a 120-acre farm near Poughkeepsie, New York, which eventually grew to an impressive 750 acres as they bought surrounding land. The Cagney family of the turn-of-the-century Lower East Side could never afford a horse, which was the primary mode of transportation back when James was a small child. So when he was able to have his own farm, he got all the horses he wanted. He loved horses. James Cagney was passionate about agriculture and conservation, and his efforts led him to receiving an honorary degree from Rollins College in Florida. All he had to do was graciously accept the honor, but he insisted on taking it one step further. He did homework. He submitted an essay to the college on soil conservation. He wanted to do at least something, even something small, to earn his degree. James Cagney retired from a long, successful career in making Hollywood films after the 1961 Billy Wilder comedy, 1-2-3. A lot had changed in filmmaking, and he was just ready to see his way to the exit. He was ready to enjoy the simple things in life. He spent his time on his farms, with his horses, he sailed, he painted, and he and Billy hosted the occasional party. He wanted to enjoy a life of leisure, and he was fortunate to have the money to do so in whatever way he chose. He was able to enjoy this wonderful retirement for about 16 years before a small stroke affected some of his abilities in 1977. It could have been a lot worse, though. The effects of the stroke left Cagney feeling a little depressed, so his wife Billy persuaded him to step back into acting, for one role at least. In 1981, 81-year-old James Cagney came out of retirement to appear in Ragtime. The film was shot in England, and James Cagney did not like to fly. So he and Billy traveled to England in old-time style aboard Cunard's QE2. His younger, way less seasoned co-stars in Ragtime were very nervous about working with the screen legend. But he was not only a wonderful co-star, but he helped and coached the younger actors along the way. While in England, he also attended the Queen Mother's birthday celebration. When he appeared on stage, the Queen Mother rose to her feet. The only time she did so during the entire event. James and Billy experienced a parent's worst heartbreak when their son James died in 1984. He had a heart attack. He was only 42 years old. Although their relationship may have gone through some difficulties, a parent losing a child is a pain that I'm sure can't be compared to anything else, no matter how old that child is. James Cagney appeared on television in the TV movie Terrible Joe Moran in 1984. This was his final credit. James Cagney died on the morning of Easter Sunday in 1986 at his beloved New York farm. He was 86 years old. James and Billy Cagney were married for 64 years. Longtime friend and sitting president of the United States of America, Ronald Reagan, delivered his eulogy. And now I would like to share some other interesting things I learned during my research. Bullet point number one. The movie Here Comes the Navy, starring James Cagney, Pat O'Brien, and Gloria Stewart, was filmed in 1934 on the USS Arizona, the ship that was attacked and sunk during the attack on Pearl Harbor in December of 1941. And Gloria Stewart? She later played Old Rose in Titanic. Bullet point number two. James Cagney's sister Jean was also an actor. She appeared in four films with her super famous brother. Bullet point number three. James Cagney was always a champion for the underdog. He had been an underdog himself, and he never forgot how it felt to work his butt off and still have a hard time putting food on the table. He was known to fake illnesses during a day of filming, so the cast and crew would have to return for an extra day of work. He did this so the extras and crew members, who he believed were grossly underpaid, would receive an extra day of pay. I bet some of them did not want to work an extra day. Bullet point number four. James Cagney provided very well for his mother until her death in 1945. No matter how much he was making, and it ended up being a lot, he always sent at least half of his paycheck to his mother, sometimes more. Bullet point number five. As I mentioned, James Cagney wasn't a fan of the rich Hollywood social scene of the 1930s and 1940s. He preferred those quiet nights at home. When he did venture out, though, it was with his best buddies, Pat O'Brien and Frank McHugh. The trio was dubbed the Irish Mafia. Sometimes other close friends would join them, men like Spencer Tracy, Bing Crosby, and Frank Morgan. Bullet point number six. Speaking of the mafia, there was a hit out on James Cagney by the real-life mafia as they tried to infiltrate the film industry for their own financial gain. He was the president of the Screen Actors Guild at the time, and they wanted him out of the way. George Raft had connections to the mob, so he stepped in and stopped the hit before it could happen. In conclusion, James Cagney rose from an impoverished life, worked his way through the Great Depression, and created a career for himself that awarded him one of the highest paychecks in Hollywood. He stood firmly by his personal values, and he advocated for himself against the studio system. More importantly, he advocated for others who didn't have the star power and the pull of James Cagney. James Cagney was a very private man. He didn't want the world to know all the details of his private life, and I totally respect that. He was, however, very candid about his love and admiration for his wife, Billy. He loved her so much. In his 1974 autobiography, after being married for over 50 years, he wrote, quote, "Marrying Billy was absolutely the smartest thing I ever did. I'm still crazy about this lady," end quote. James Cagney was a man who looked out for others. He helped others in the film industry. He helped others in his communities on Martha's Vineyard in Dutchess County, New York. He helped others in politics. And he was always there to help his friends. The area where I believe he failed, however, is the one area that held more importance than all of those things combined. His children. It doesn't seem like James and Billy knew how to be good parents. Their idea of parenting was isolation from their children, from what I gathered. And the one thing every child needs, if nothing else can be provided to them, is love and acceptance. James Cagney's children didn't feel they received that from their parents. Thank you, James Cagney, for being our tough guy, but for also having such great versatility in your talent. You could be a gangster one day and a song and dance guy the next. Thank you for putting so much energy into helping others. You took your position of success and used it to help others. You had karma on your side for sure. And thank you all for listening. And now I would like to read a review of the week. This one comes from Spotify from Dee Brady, who is also a Patreon member. I think it's you, Deborah. This was a comment on the Ginger Rogers episode. She said, "Love this one. I've been following your podcast since like episode 3. It's been great to hear your storytelling skills get better and better with each one. I'm a Patreon member as well, and I love the drinks episodes." Thank you so much. I sure love those cocktail party episodes too. They are so fun to do. I can't thank you enough for supporting the show on Patreon. I truly, truly appreciate it. And as for my storytelling, yes, it has definitely come a long way. In fact, I keep thinking about how I would love to revisit a couple of those first episodes, like Vivian Lee and Billy Burke and a handful of other ones. I think Humphrey Bogart was only like 18 minutes long. There's so much more I could say about him. I would just love to go back and do a little deeper dive into some of those. I mean, you can see a lot of those early episodes are way shorter than the ones of today. I was definitely finding my groove, which I think every show probably goes through. But I love having deeper research now. I want to share as much as I can about these people. So I would just love to revisit some of those early ones and add a little more for them. So you may see some of that someday. Now, the show has really grown, which I love, and I'm hoping that it continues to grow. But as I'm learning, with growth comes some negativity sprinkled in with those amazing comments like this one. Not many at all, but a couple have come in, some about my voice that, again, I can't really change. It was suggested, actually, that I see a vocal coach, but the person didn't say what the problem was, just that they didn't like the delivery of my words. So, I don't know, maybe it's my Minnesota accent, but my number one priority in my life is my preschool students, and they respond pretty well to my voice, and I don't want to scare them by changing my voice at all and talking different. So we're just going to stick with this voice and this accent for now. Plus, honestly, I do not have any time to see a vocal coach. Maybe someday I can revisit that, but I put every minute of my free time into creating good content for the show and editing the episodes, so we're just going to have to stick with this for now. So along the lines of these negative comments, not just on my show, but I see them on all kinds of podcasts. I see them all over social media. There's just negativity everywhere. So about these negative comments, like I said, there's not many. It's mostly positive, and I thank you guys so much for that. I'm really doing the best I can. But circling back to my kids, my preschool students, in my job, in my career, my top priority as an early childhood educator is teaching and modeling kindness. Yes, I teach them all kinds of academic stuff to get them ready for kindergarten, but my number one priority, aside from keeping them safe, is modeling kindness. I have a really, really, really important role in these kids' lives. This time in their life is so crucial in their character development, in their personalities, in the kind of people that they're going to be. And I want to send kind and compassionate humans out into this world. So that is my biggest goal. I would way rather them understand how to be kind and empathetic than to be able to write a letter K before they enter elementary school. So modeling kindness has just been a huge part of my every single day for almost 20 years now. And it still just floors me when I see such negativity online and so much hostility towards others. And I'm expanding this message to the comment sections on various posts. I see it all over the place. It is really, really ugly out there. So much so that I really don't spend any time on social media at all anymore. It's just too negative. So anyway, leaving all that stuff behind, back to this show. I am so happy to have all of your positive feedback, and it just really helps keep me going. Because honestly, this is a lot of work. So as I keep plugging along, I will find healthy ways to handle the negativity that comes in. I know it's just always going to be there. And I'm all for constructive criticism, but that word constructive is really important. Just plain criticism doesn't really help. So why I spend so much time talking about this, it's not because of the stuff directed at me, per se. It's just that I see it all over the place. And I just want to remind people that when you're leaving feedback for anything, especially something like this where it's directed at one sole individual, just be kind. Just remember that you are talking to a real-life human with real-life emotions. Just maybe think before you type, would I say this directly to that person's face? It's just really easy to be disrespectful and downright mean sometimes behind a keyboard and a screen. And there are some days when I wish the internet was never invented. But if it weren't, we wouldn't have this wonderful platform to create and enjoy podcast content so easily. So maybe we can just start being nicer on the internet. Just be nice. It is so easy. I have some really, really wonderful and supportive listeners, so I am choosing to keep my focus primarily on your lovely words. So thank you. Thank you all so much. And when the negative ones do come in, my number one fan is always there to reassure me. My mom. Yes, I still go running to my mommy with things. In fact, I'm going to read you the comment that she left on my Ginger Rogers episode, just so you can see how amazingly supportive she is. This is the kind of person that I've had in my corner since before I was born. And I'm pretty lucky to have her in my life. My mom wrote, "Very well done, Erin. Your sweet words brought tears. I am blessed to have such a talented, ambitious daughter who works so hard while keeping the delicate balance of dedication to her work as a teacher, podcaster, wife, daughter, and dog mom to her three fur daughters. And thank you for bringing Ginger Rogers' life to us." I am a pretty lucky lady to have a mom like that, aren't I? Well, guess what, Mom? You are the one that raised me to be who I am today. So I think we can thank you for all of the wonderful things you said. Listen, I don't know what the future holds for this little podcast. I hope it holds success and longevity. But whatever it is, I hope I can accomplish at least two things with this show. Number one, I want to shine a light on some lives that matter, our stars. Keep those legacies alive. And two, I want to leave a positive impact. I want to be a model of kindness and positivity to others, just as I do in my preschool classroom every single day. Kindness has never hurt anyone, not that I know of at least. Those are my intentions, and honestly, in this hateful world we live in, if I can make even one person think before they act, and they choose kindness over hate, well, then I consider my intentions successful. Just be nice, that's all. Thanks, guys, and thank you for letting me rant about that. Reach for the positive in every day, be kind to everyone you encounter, and have a great rest of your week. My primary source for this episode was a book titled American Legends, The Life of James Cagney by Charles River Editors. I also use the SAG-AFTRA site at sagaftra.org, an article from Martha's Vineyard magazine by Carla Arujo, an article from the Vineyard Gazette by Kevin R. Laughlin from February 1st, 2024, an article from the New York Times from February 2nd, 1984 about the death of James Cagney's son, the New England Historical Society, and IMDb. If you're a fan of dissecting pop culture, subscribe and listen to Pop Culture 5 with Deremy Dove and Thomas Senna. Deremy and Thomas take any given pop culture topic and break it down to its five essentials. Anything from five essential Tom Hanks movies to five essential Seinfeld episodes. Do you love music? Deremy and Thomas cover artists ranging from Beyonce to the Rolling Stones. Have some fun and play along with them. You can listen to Pop Culture 5 wherever you get your podcasts.